FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's 7-11-17. This could be your lucky day. Good number to play. If you're going to go buy lottery tickets, go to a 7-Eleven and play 7-11-17. And who knows? Your luck could change. However, there is an objective reality out there. Things aren't necessarily getting worse, but they aren't necessarily getting better either. And we're really pleased to have Sam McElroy. Sam, you're co-founder of At Financial and At Financial Investments. I mean, you've been at this a long time. What really makes your take on finances interesting is the fact that you hold a doctorate in psychology. And let's face it, markets always boil down to psychology, don't they? Well, first, welcome to the show. Oh, and if you have any questions for myself or Sam, email kl@kerrylutz.com. Sam, again, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kerry.
So, psychology. Supposedly, the economy added 222,000 jobs in June, but at the same time, Microsoft is cutting back on jobs. And, well, forget about the retail sector. The retail apocalypse continues unabated. So where are we right now?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a mixed bag. And the truth is, you know, it's easy to get caught up in headlines when you see stuff like, you know, the U.S. economy gained 220,000 jobs in June. So that number looks big. And because it looks big, it has this psychological impact that it makes us think that things are just, you know, all rosy and there's, you know, nothing but clear skies ahead of us. But if we look at any of this information and really start to dig into it, I think you're exactly right. At best, we have to call it a mixed bag. Because while we do see maybe some jobs numbers that are improving, we see certain sectors that are having all types of problems right now. And I think there's a lot more to what's happening on an economic standpoint than looking at just one indicator and trying to extrapolate a lot of meaningful data from just that one piece.
Right. So like you say, it's a lot more than just a couple of numbers, what's actually taking place in the economy. And well, wages did go up a little bit, not great, 2.5%. The job market, how strong is it really? Because that number is the U1, and that just tells you who stopped collecting unemployment. It doesn't necessarily tell you the structurally unemployed, the long-term unemployed, whether they are getting jobs or not. And 4.4% unemployment is very deceiving because it doesn't include people who are underemployed chronically, like engineers flipping burgers at fast food restaurants who will soon be displaced by Flippy, the burger flipping robot, right? It really lacks a lot of it. It doesn't tell us who's left the workforce. Workforce participation rates really have not improved all that much since the so-called recovery started almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And we do see a number of people that are just making changes. You know, one of the things that we really specialize in is retirement planning. And I had a number of clients in particular this year, more so than other years, that, you know, were planning on working another 2, 3, 4 years that, you know, either got forced out of job, downsized, laid off. Now, technically, they're retired. But in a sense, if their job was still there or if they were able to kind of have gainful employment, there's a number of people that we work with that I know would have preferred to work a little bit longer. So there is a lot of interpretation and kind of misleading data that can go into any jobs report and that can go into this unemployment number as a whole. I think we also have to remember that, you know, unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. So while it is a good way of looking at maybe what has happened in a short-term trend with respect to the U.S. economy, it's not necessarily the best at predicting where we're going in the future. And I think that's where we really have to start to look at not just the unemployment numbers, but a number of different factors. You know, GDP growth, the GDP trend, the earnings growth for the S&P 500, and other things like that that can give us some indication as far as what we think is happening now and where we think things are going to go in the future as well.
Right. And yeah, so it is a lagging indicator like many. But now the stock market used to be a leading indicator. Do you think it's lost its usefulness as a leading indicator at this point, Sam?
You know, it's so hard to tell, because if I think over the last 2 or 3 years, I think a lot of the truisms that we used to hold as far as predicting stock market behavior have gone atypical. So they've done things that maybe everybody didn't expect them to do. You know, if we look at what happened with the stock market, and we basically saw this surge following the election. I think anytime we see a spike or a pop in the market, we always have to pause and ask ourselves, you know, what is the root cause for this? Is something happening where businesses are all of a sudden more profitable to where I should actually be paying more, putting a higher valuation on the shares for that business? And if that's not the case, if that's not what's causing the market to gain, then what is it? And my fear is that in this instance, a lot of it is just investor exuberance. It's a lot of hope because we want things to be better. We want the market to continue on this upward trend. But I think what we've seen is a widening spread in the price to earnings ratio. We're putting a larger valuation on companies. And I don't know if their earnings have really been there to justify that valuation. And I think that if we're trying to then use the market behavior as an indicator, I think it is losing a little bit of its predictive power, because in a sense, there's a lot of things in the stock market valuation currently today that maybe aren't good or aren't really aligned with fundamental economics.
Right. And so we look at the stock market, so we think it's becoming divorced from reality, or is it just to become a big casino that has no relation to the real economy? What's going on here, Sam?
I think it's a little bit of both. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's not reflecting some growth improvement that we've had, because I think if we look at what was going on during the financial crisis to where we are today, I think some things have improved. I think the problem is whenever things start to improve, gas or hit the accelerator on the gas pedal, and we kind of take this incremental increase and stretch it into this out of proportion larger increase, I think that's where the rise. So I think there are some things that are actually happening that's good, that justify some growth from the market. And I think oftentimes when you come off of a rebound, the tendency is to continue kind of up past where you know, when you started to fall. I think the problem is that now we're starting to outrun basically where the economy was spurring us on. And in a sense, we're building in additional risk in the market.
Interesting. So the question is, what's going to happen to the high flyers? This really comes down to a very small number of stocks that are basically the tail wagging the dog when you get down to it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we saw, especially last week, is that the tech sector is having a big impact. And when it's down, the market's down. When it recovers, the market recovers. And so we definitely are seeing a disproportional amount of smaller stocks having a greater impact on market trends kind of as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Which is a bad sign generally when you have a narrowing participation in the stock market's advance, right?
Yeah, because in a sense, what you really want to see is more diversification. Not in the sense of diversifying by asset classes, but you want to see more companies kind of sharing the load with, so to speak, of growth inside the market. And to the extent that you have that, then you're not really hedging your bet on the success of any one or any, you know, handful of companies. But when you see this kind of narrowing margin, the problem is that if something were to happen to those particular stocks, then it tends to happen to the overall market. And then you get into this kind of cyclical process, because we know that inside of a lot of mutual funds are a lot of these stocks. And when people start to pull back from the market, they don't necessarily pay attention to, well, is this a good stock that I should hold on to? When they start pulling out of funds in particular, it tends to have this effect where we say, you know, all ships rise and fall with the tide.
Right. Well, on the other hand, to take the old cliche, stocks go up on a wall of worry. Stocks go higher on a wall of worry. We haven't had any shortage of a wall of worry, have we?
Nope, we certainly haven't.
So from a contrarian, if you assume that most investors are wrong or most participants are wrong, then maybe the market will keep going up, right?
Yeah, I think it's a good possibility. But, you know, a little analogy that I use is if you really think about the market and follow it over a longer trend period, we see these periods where it basically expands and contracts and expands and contracts, almost like any system trying to seek equilibrium. So it's almost like, you know, you can have the tide that kind of is coming in and out. And maybe for a period, there may be a hurricane and the hurricane winds create this surge where it's never able to come back out. But over a long enough period of time, you know that it has to kind of contract a little bit so that it can get healthy again, kind of replenish its nutrients. And in a sense, I think that's where the market's at now. I feel like there's a lot of things going on from a macro global economic standpoint that's artificially bolstering the valuations that we're putting on the U.S. stock market. I don't necessarily think a contraction is a bad thing. I think in a sense it's almost cathartic because we need it to help get us back to a healthier place with respect to just fundamental economics. So I think that really what we're talking about is looking at more purpose-based versus performance-based investing. And what that means is people really have to think about what they're investing for. You know, if somebody's in their 20s and 30s and really their main goal is to accumulate wealth, then it may be okay. Yeah, there may be a lot of risk in the market, but you know that you're going to work your way through it. So over a long enough period of time, you may have some bad times, some good times, but you're going to be okay. I think what's really important is for people that are in retirement or close to retirement, what they have to consider is it worth the risk to try to eke out another couple of percentage points, being a little bit more aggressive? Is that practically going to change their retirement, practically going to change their life as compared to, you know, if they were to contract 10, 20, 30%, what impact would that have on their life? And I think that's how they can then start to assess risk and to what degree it makes sense for them to stay in the market or pull back from the market. So.
And everyone, if you're investing, if you're saving for retirement, you need to become an effective risk manager, right?
Yep, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things that we look at, especially when we're talking about, you know, if you're taking income or pulling money out of an account, is that it seems like the losses actually are more impactful than the gains are. So to the degree that we can mitigate losses, we actually don't need as large gains to be able to be in the same or a better position. So I think risk management is definitely the name game when you do personal investing. I think for an institutional investor, they still need to manage risk, but the way they manage risk might be a little bit different. But for a personal investor, where typically they need this money for some purpose, either to pay for college, to buy a house, to fund their retirement, they definitely need to be a master of managing what we call the inside game, which is all about risk management.
And that is the hardest thing to do because it really deals with your assessment of the future. And as Yogi Berra said, prediction is very tough, especially when you're dealing with the future. So
that's right.
Yeah. So really, you have to, it's the hardest thing in the world because, look, you got to get a hold on your emotions, right? Fear and greed are prevalent in all of us, animal spirits, whatever you want to call it, right? And, you know,
that's right.
It's
yeah, me, I mean, in a sense, yeah. We really are our own worst enemies. You know, we all like to think that we make sound, rational financial decisions. But the truth of the matter, that the same subconscious processes that kind of lead us to decision making in other areas of our life, whether it's, you know, jobs or making a purchase or retail purchase or relationships or whatever it might be, are the same processes that influence how we govern and work with money. So when we look at things like the recency effect, where we tend to place too much value on the most recent data, even if it's not the most meaningful, or confirmation bias, where, you know, we tend to prefer information that already determines what we already think. So all of these pieces are actually skewing the way that we actually view and assess information. And oftentimes it leads us to making the wrong decision.
Yeah, very, very true. And we are our own worst enemies in investing as in the rest of life. And that's why you really need to become aware of the concepts that you and I have been talking about, Sam. And if you want to learn more about this, Sam, where do you go? Where's the best place to find your work?
Yeah, easiest way to connect with us is probably through our website, www.atfinancial.com. You know, from there, people can sign up for our newsletters. You know, we tend to put out the market commentaries, other things like that. They can find our blog and other information from there.
All right. And hey, if you've got any questions again for Sam or myself, email kl@kerrylutz.com. The Twitter feed is @KerryLutz. The Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. And of course, as always, we'll have a link to Sam's site in the show notes of this interview on Financial Survival Network. Sam, been a pleasure having you on. We'll look forward to speaking with you again, and thank you so much.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.